Mary? Nathan? Let's see what you got here. I thought you were going to the piano for a second.
Oh, sorry.
And I thought you were going to play.
It wouldn't sound that good. Amen. So, are you a man on the piano?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Chase got it.
On a cold January morning about 2 decades ago, NASA launch director Mike Reinbach bid farewell to the departing crew of a much delayed space shuttle mission with the words, "All good things come to those who wait." I thought I'd found it at the time, but I've tried to live my life according to those words, and the adventure of the last 2 years has certainly led up to that mantra. And the coincidentally, was October of the year 2016. My father and I had planned to take a trip to the Davis Mountains in 2017 to image the Milky Way galaxy as part of a photo learning experience. I think we wanted to try that. It was different from what we had tried before. And as it was, life has a way of happening, and we ended up having to cancel the trip. But we weren't going to let that get us down. Let's go to the first slide. Decided to try it a little bit closer to home near the small town of Orchard, Texas, which is about 45 minutes from Houston Central to the south-southwest. Far enough out to see the galaxy, but we still encountered the heavy light pollution of surrounding towns and central Houston. And being as it were, we were completely new to this practice, and we did not use the proper equipment for it, and the images were less than what we had desired. So about 2 weeks later, we tried again in the town of Independence. And any Bale Bears out here, I see at least two of them.
Yeah.
This is actually the original site of Baylor University, with a replica bell tower erected on the site of the university. They moved to Waco, I think, in 1885. Anyway, we tried a new location, new equipment, better view, almost. What we didn't anticipate was that the half moon would completely wash out the galaxy. You can barely see it coming up from the left corner. But we're still there. You can go to the next one. I started off 2018, June, with a visit to my hometown of San Angelo. For those who don't know where it is, it's about 6 hours due west of here. Small, about 85,000 people, but the great thing is easy access to the dark skies of West Texas. And I had two nights here, and on the first night I rolled out to the western part of the city hoping to catch the Milky Way overhead. But unfortunately, the clouds had obviously been planned. But as I woke up in the middle of the night, for some reason, something called out to me about 3:30 in the morning, saying, "Open the blinds and look outside." I second light you see in this image is a distant star within our galaxy, or even possibly a galaxy beyond our own. And the galactic core, which is shown here, contains a relatively small number of stars, about 10 million, amongst the 250 billion plus in our galaxy. And that core is approximately 26,500 light years from Earth, meaning the light that left the core 26,500 light years ago and is just now reaching our eyes. So if you see it not as it was, or not as it is now, not as it was yesterday or even 100 years ago, but as it was at the time of the last ice age here on Earth. And one of the questions that my dad and I pondered as we looked into all of this, as we looked across the vastness of space, what makes us special? Why did God choose this lonely pale blue dot for habitation amongst the vastness of creation as we see it? Why were we chosen for salvation? And in this vast expanse, are we alone? And if not, were they chosen as well? And I don't pose these questions for answers. I certainly don't have them, and I don't suspect anyone else out there does. But I ask these to illustrate the profound experience that we can have when imaging the heavens above. Although I suspect one day we'll know those answers, because as I said, I'll get links to those.
Maybe can I ask you a few questions? We're going to kind of get a little bit esoteric, spiritual, and mysterious for you. I have everybody up there, but go back to the first one. Let's kind of walk through these just a little bit.
You just
hit
one there, or two there.
Is that one?
Yeah.
So that's your kind of first effort. Tell us just a little bit about how you do this, photographically speaking. What's the craft? What's the science?
It depends on what you want the image to look like. In this case, we wanted something that showed a lot of the sky, so a wide angle lens comes in handy. A DSLR mounted atop a tripod and a remote trigger to allow you to open the shutter and expose the sensor to the lightning that's coming in from the sky.
And how long is the lens open? How long is the.
So the shutter was open in this case, I believe, about 20 seconds.
And how, like, if you're out there and you look up, you don't see that, do you?
The Milky Way, you can't actually see it. It appears almost as a thin cirrus cloud.
Good. And so what does this look like when you're actually looking at it?
It just looks like a dusty cloud in the sky, a big pillar.
Tell us how you did the SNBC.
Do what?
Tell us how you did the SNBC.
I took a flashlight, turned it on as I wrote each letter, and I just kept moving to the left and right each one.
Just during the 20-second opening of the...
I think I got that one done in 15. You tried to make it a record.
Now tell us that we set the cell phone, Patty. Is that just... Are you just standing?
I turned the flashlight on the phone. I want to say it went against the flagpole. It could have been a gravestone. I can't remember. But it lit up the church pretty well. And it doesn't look like that to your eye. Your eye can't detect that. But you leave the camera on and pop the shutter open long enough that it'll pick up the light.
And maybe let us know a little bit about the science behind that. And I know it's got the light coming through the lens. And, you know, but how does that, how does the longer you open the shutter, how much what you see in the picture, I assume, is more
It's from Ray Bradbury's The Sun, 1967. Description of the Grim Reaper. Sobbing wildly, he rose above the grain again and again, and hewed left and right, and to the left, and to the right, and to the left, and to the right. Over and over and over, slicing out huge stars of green and wheat, and ripe wheat, with no selection and no care, cursing over and over, swearing and laughing, the blade swinging up in the sun and falling in the sun with a singing whistle down. Bombs shattered London, Moscow, Tokyo. The blade swung insanely, and the kilns of Belsen and Lubaldin took fire. The blade sang crimson wet. And mushrooms vomited out blind suns at White Sands, Hiroshima, Bikini, and up through and in the continental Siberian skies. The grain wept in green rain falling. Korea, Indochina, Egypt, India trembled, Asia stirred, Africa woke in the night. And the blade went on rising, crashing, severing with the fury and rage of a man who has lost and lost and lost so much that he no longer cares for what he does to the world. And that's Rick Bradbury. The piece I'd like to do for you now with Yuri is called The Incorruptible Sun. And if you've met me for 5 minutes, you'll know that I love Star Wars just about more than anything in the world in terms of fictional narrative. I wrote this piece a while back, but it still it says something for this time period for me, because when I was a child, I wasn't under the impression you couldn't grow up to be a Jedi Knight, but apparently they don't have that position anywhere. Sadly, the Force does not exist in the way that we perceive it in that narrative. But this is for your enjoyment. It's The Incorruptible Sun. This story happened a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It is already over. Nothing can be done to change it. The strange thing about stories, though this happened so long ago and so far away, the words cannot describe the time or the distance. It is happening here, right now. It's happening even as you listen to these words. You are reliving it now in your heart because you remember. In the first act of Star Wars, A New Hope, Luke Skywalker takes 19 steps toward desolate horizon emblazoned by a binary sunset. The audience, ushered forward by John Williams' score, sees a longing in Luke that the more elderly viewer knows is afforded to only the very young. As time passes in our lives, the reality of the mundane world chips away at our sense of the miraculous. Time is corrosive to both the body and the soul. Through that corrosion, our experiences reshape us. With experience comes wisdom, and sadly, wisdom oftentimes replaces wonder. Wisdom is important. It is the timeless teacher which keeps us from making the same mistakes we stole away with as children. Wisdom is the sword of the mind. It guards us against those who might seek to treat us like sheep, shear us, or slaughter us. But wonder, oh wonder, that burning belief inside the tender heart which roots itself in the fantasies and magic of tremendous and faraway places. Places that can only be reached by bridges of great and indeterminable working. Workings that transform wardrobes into doorways, turn mirrors into silver windows. They take us to realms where an orphan slave can become a messiah, where a princess can become a capable freedom fighter, where a mercenary can become a captain of the guard, and where a farmer boy can become an incorruptible redeemer. And that boy, the son of a prodigal father, a father who had the power to bring an entire galaxy into harmony, a While it may seem silly to an emotionally waxing Star Wars at the age of 36, I cannot help but still be moved by this singular notion that no matter who our parents are, no matter how their flaws come to light as we age, we will always be yearning to see them as we did when we were young, as good people, as heroes. And this feeling wells up inside of me every single time I watch Star Wars. You know the scene I mean. Here at the beginning of the third act of Return of the Jedi, when Luke surrenders himself over to Vader, the very person standing in the way of him becoming a Jedi Knight, that patriarch who has murdered millions, including Luke's foster parents, and maimed him by cutting off his hand. Despite all these personal horrors, Luke still works toward his father's salvation. Through all the bad Darth Vader put upon the galaxy, not a single person living among the stars of that universe would feel poorly to see Darth Vader's life end in a horrific fashion. But to Luke, Vader is worth the pain of salvation. To everyone else, the Dark Lord of the Sith is the scourge of the galaxy, the mask worn on the face of war. To everyone else, Darth Vader is a monster, and to Luke Skywalker, he's a father. And it is true that the sons of monsters need not be monsters themselves. And it is in that moment when Luke, manacled and helpless without the one tool of protection, looks to his father, that black knight of death and destruction. And Luke this time takes 2 steps, not 19. And with that same youthful hope in his captivating eyes, he says, "Come with me. Because no one else matters to me but you. Because I love you.
So that y'all share one mic. Yuri, talk to us a little bit about the role of mystery in music. I know very little about music other than I enjoy it a lot. I know G is a happy key. E flat is a kind of a melancholy key. How does a composer evoke mystery?
Generally speaking, stability, harmonically. So if you have staple harmonies, it's very conclusive and there's no mystery because you know exactly where it's going. Composer will, if they're trying to evoke that kind of mood, of course avoid the traditional functions of harmony, and they'll explore new ways to
does it? Who does it best? You said Mendelssohn?
Fanny Mendelssohn, his sister. She wrote a lot of great music, but in particular, her songs are really interesting in the way that they play with hyperbeater. And also Beethoven, of course, in his piano sonatas, and typically a fast movement, like a scherzo from one of his symphonies, Beethoven 9. It plays a lot with the hypermeter, where it's a really fast tempo on the surface. Right, you hear all the eighth notes, and you're like, "Wow, it's fast." But if you slow it down in your mind, and you're just listening to one bar at a time, you'll see this larger hypermeter that kind of form, you know, like the Milky Way galaxy, you know, kind of revealing itself.
So, same kind of question for a writer. I know your genre is horror, but there's a part of mystery in that. How does a writer evoke the supernatural or the transcendent, but still remain sort of plausible in a way? Or do you just bust right through that?
People who read my stuff would say, oh, it's always just busting right through. It's usually a big monster.
Yeah, but there has to be sort of a kernel of that's my experience too. Just that sense of wonder, which I guess brings us back to one of the statements that you made, or that you wrote, Seth, was that tension between wisdom and wonder. Discuss.
And
I have to think that wonder became a part of the draw for you to go out and look up and see. How did you first become interested in doing something like this? Was it interested in photography? Was it interested in just seeing things that we can't quite see? Or what drew you to this in particular?
So I've always enjoyed capturing memories and photography allows me to put my own artistic spin on it, capturing a way that the human eye may not see. I actually got my first camera 2 days before my daughter was born. I was an active girl on it. It becomes a brain builder at some point. You always want to try something new. There's always the potential to learn something different. And I always feel if I keep doing the same thing over and over again, it's stagnating.
And when did you first see that, hey, this is not just snapping some pictures, but there really is some art to this, or artistry to this? When did that crossover occur?
I would say sometime about 3 years ago. Those who know me probably know I spend a lot of time in the airport taking pictures of airplanes, but at some point it becomes a little bad. And I want to go out and try something new. And I kept seeing pictures like this online. I thought that'd be a good place to start.
But Yuri, I mean, I know that you started playing very early on. When did you realize, hey, I'm like better than anybody else?
Sixth grade.
And what did that mean? Was it just commitment? Or I know part of it is just natural gift, but how did that sort of that realization come to you?
So many realms of my life. I don't want there to be anything that I personally can't do. I don't want there to be a piece of music out there that I can't play. I don't want there to be an instrument that I can't play. At one point in my undergrad, I was playing piano as my major, organ as my secondary, and violin as my third instrument. And I was like, no, okay, I can quit something. And it was violin. That was like the first time I dropped an instrument.
Well, and that does bring up, I'm going to switch mics with you. I like my mic better than I like theirs, so you want to hear them more than me. Piano versus organ. Talk about that.
Well, it was